Sutta Goswami has concluded the narration of Maharaj Prakrit, which on one level it's a sub-end of the Bhagavatam. He's explained the way of removing the effects of Maya by focusing the consciousness upon Vishnu or Krishna. And then before he directly ends the Shastra, he says, such devotees, one should tolerate all insults and never fail to show proper respect to any person. Avoiding identification with the material body, one should not create enmity with anyone. So, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that if a person commits offenses, the form of Vishnu will disappear, meaning from his consciousness. The method of avoiding offenses is now taught. One should tolerate sharp words. One should not answer sharp words with equally harsh words. So then in the final verse that he speaks here, he says, as we said at the end, Namo Bhagavate Tasmai Krishnaya Kuntamedase Yat Padam Bruha Dhyanat Samhitam Adhyadam Imam. I offer my obeisances to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the invincible Lord Sri Krishna. Simply by meditating upon his lotus feet, I've been able to study and appreciate this great literature. So in this verse, as we said, Samhitam Adhyagamimam. The Samhita, the Srimad Bhagavatam. And then after hearing this reference to the Bhagavatam, to this compilation of all the Puranic literatures, bringing the essence to the forefront of all the Puranic literatures, Nigama Kalpataru Galitam Phalam, the ripened fruit of all the Vedas, Shonaka Rishi responds with a question, and he says, O gentle Sutta, please narrate to us how Paila and other greatly intelligent disciples of Srila Vyasadeva, who are known as the standard authorities of Vedic wisdom, spoke and edited the Vedas. So Vishwanath, he tells in a sentence what the rest of this chapter is about, and also in addition the next chapter. He says the sages want to know about the division of the Vedas Samhitas, because they've heard about the Samhita, the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the ripened fruit of all the Vedas. They want to hear about the rest of the tree, how it came about, because again, this is the essence. The Bhagavatam is the essence of all the Vedic literatures. So Sutta begins his reply in text 37. O Brahmana, first, now I want to tell you that there is a Falshruti at the end of this, it's actually at the end of the next chapter. If you want your spiritual strength to increase, yes, that if you hear this narration, one's spiritual strength increases. So if you feel you're in the need of an increase in your spiritual strength, please listen carefully. If you don't feel like you're in need of an increase in your spiritual strength, then do something else. So he's going to respond how the Vedas came into being, and also he's going to describe the different divisions by the different rishis. This is also described in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, in the first canto, when Vyasa is feeling disheartened after having compiled all the Vedic literature. So this is an expansion of those principles. So Sutta said, O Brahmana, first the subtle vibration of transcendental sound appeared from the sky of the heart of the most elevated Lord Brahma. So something subtle came from the Brahma from the heart of Lord Brahma, this akashat, out of the sky, adbhut nada, this transcendental sound that is very, very subtle, came out of the heart of Lord Brahma, whose mind was perfectly fixed in spiritual realization. One can perceive this subtle vibration when one stops all external hearing. So this isn't the recommended process of spiritual realization in the age, going like this and not hearing anything. Rather, the opposite process is recommended, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, hearing the holy names of the Lord. Just let me go back one little bit before we go on forward. That in that final verse spoken by Sutta, where he ended the narration of the pastimes, Namo Bhagavate Tasmai, offering obeisances to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, unto him, Krishnaya Akuntamedasa, whose power cannot be stopped. It is unimpeatable. Then he says, Yat Padam Bruha Dhyanat, by meditating on his lotus feet, Samitam Adhyagam Imam, I have assimilated this scripture. Now he's heard it, but his hearing wasn't the only point that allowed him, that caused him to assimilate it. What does assimilate mean? When you eat food and your body can assimilate the nutrients, then you gain the benefit from it. You can eat, but if you're having weak digestion, you're not assimilating the proteins, the carbohydrates, all the vitamins and minerals, then even though you're eating, you're not gaining the benefit of what you're eating. So my question is, what was the process that he recommended for being able to, he didn't recommend it at this point, but he said was his sort of secret formula for assimilating the message of the Bhagavatam. He heard, but then that is compared to like the eating. Now, how did he assimilate? What did he specifically say?
Yeah,
he meditated on the Lord's feet, which means that he was hearing as a service. He was surrendering to the words of Sukadeva, and he was hearing as his service, his devotional service. And he was seeing this as the Lord's transcendental body. He was doing it as a service, meditating upon the Lord's feet. He was seeing the Shastra as none different from Krishna. So he had that much respect and reverence, and he was associating with Krishna as he was doing it. And therefore he assimilated. And he's offering his respect to his deity, the Supreme Lord Krishna. That's what Vishwanath comments. Now we shall continue. So first, Sutta is describing the transcendental, subtle emanation from Brahma, from his heart, from his exalted consciousness. And his consciousness was most elevated because his mind was perfectly fixed in spiritual realization. And one can perceive this subtle vibration when one stops all external hearing. By worship of this subtle form of the Vedas, O Brahmana, mystic sages cleanse their heart of all contamination caused by impurity of substance, activity, and doer, and thus they attain freedom from repeated birth and death. So first there was this subtle sound vibration coming from the heart of Brahma. From that transcendental subtle vibration arose the Omkar, composed of three sounds. The Omkar has unseen potencies and manifests automatically within a purified heart. It is the representation of the Absolute Truth in all three of its phases, the Supreme Personality, the Supreme Soul, Supersoul, and the Supreme Impersonal Truth. So all are present in the Omkar. The Omkar, the ultimately non-material and imperceptible, is heard by the Supersoul without his possessing material ears or any other material senses. The entire expanse of Vedic sound is elaborated from Omkar, because he's going to describe the manifestation of the Vedic literature. So here is the primal foundational manifestation in two successive stages. First, this most subtle stage coming from the heart of Lord Brahma, and then secondarily, that is manifest into the Omkar, which is non-material, is imperceptible. Although it is imperceptible, it contains, somehow represents the three aspects of the Absolute Truth, Brahmeti, Paramatmati, Bhagavaneti. And in addition, even though it is imperceptible, it is heard. But it is heard by the Supersoul. The entire expanse of Vedic sound is elaborated from Omkar, which appears from the soul within the sky of the heart. It is the direct designation of the self originating, the self-originating Absolute Truth, the Supersoul, and is the secret essence and eternal seed of the Vedic hymns. Omkar exhibited the three original sounds of the alphabet, A, O, and M. These three, O most eminent descendant of Bhrigu, sustain all the different threefold aspects of material existence, including the three modes of nature, the names of the Rig, Yajur, and Samavedas, the goals known as Bhur, Bhuva, and Swa planetary systems, and the three functional platforms called awakening consciousness, sleep, and deep sleep. So they are all sustained, all these emanations are sustained by the Omkar. From that Omkar, Lord Brahma created all the sounds of the alphabet, the vowels, the consonants, semi-vowels, sibilants, and others, distinguished by such features as long and short measure. All-powerful Brahma made use of this collection of sounds to produce from his four faces the four Vedas, which appeared together with the syllable Omkar and the seven Vyariti invocations. His intention was to propagate the process of Vedic sacrifice according to the different functions performed by the priests of each of the four Vedas. So Vishwanath explains more or less the purpose behind this explanation. In order to correctly define the fruit of the tree of the Vedas, which is the Srimad Bhagavatam again, Nigama Kalpatam, Galitam, Phalam, he briefly describes the branches of the Vedas. First, he's describing how the Vedas appear. Nada, or this subtle vibration, appeared from the ether in the heart of Brahma. This sound can be understood by a person if he blocks the ears. Conjectured. And then also, the four Vedas, oh, this comes a little bit later. So Brahma then taught these Vedas to his sons, who were great sages amongst the Brahmanas and experts in the arts of Vedic recitation. They in turn took the role of acharyas and imparted the Vedas to their own sons. In this way, throughout the cycle of four ages, generation after generation of disciples, all firmly fixed in their spiritual vows, have received these Vedas by disciplic succession. At the end of each Dwapara Yuga, the Vedas are edited into separate divisions by eminent sages. Observing that the people in general were diminished in their lifespan, strength, and intelligence by the influence of time, great sages took inspiration from the personality of Godhead sitting within their hearts and systematically divided the Vedas. O Brahmana, in the presence of Vaivasatamanu, the leaders of the universe, led by Brahma and Shiva, requested the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the protector of all the worlds, to save the principles of religion. O most fortunate Shonaka, the Almighty Lord, exhibiting a divine spark of a portion of his plenary portion, then appeared in the womb of Satyavati as the son of Parasara. In this form, named Krishna Dwapayana Vyas, he divided the one Veda into four. Srila Vyasadeva separated the mantras of the Rig, Atharva, Yajur, and Samavedas into four divisions, just as one sorts out a mixed collection of jewels and piles into piles. Thus he composed four distinct Vedic literatures. Purport. When Lord Brahma first spoke the four Vedas with his four mouths, the mantras were mixed together like an unsorted collection of various types of jewels. Srila Vyasadeva sorted the Vedic mantras into four divisions, samhitas, which thus became the recognizable Rig, Atharva, Yajur, and Samavedas. The most powerful and intelligent Vyasadeva called four of his disciples, O Brahmana, and entrusted to each of them one of these four samhitas. Srila Vyasadeva taught the first samhita, the Rig Veda, to Pila, and gave this collection the name Bhavritcha. To the sage named Vaishapayan, he spoke the collection of the Yajur mantras named Nigada, and he taught the Samaveda mantras designated as the Chandogya Samhita to Jaimini, and he spoke the Atharva Veda to his dear disciple Sumantu. After dividing his samhita into two parts, the wise Paila spoke it to Indra Pramati and Bhaskal. Bhaskal further divided his collection into four parts, O Bhagava, and instructed them to his disciple Bodhya, Yajnavalkya, Parasarya, and Agnimitra, the four of them. Indra Pramati, the self-controlled sage, taught his samhita to the learned mystic Mandukya, whose disciple Devamitra later passed down the divisions of the Rig Veda to Sobhari and others. The sons of Mandukya, named Shakalya, the son of Mandukya, named Shakalya, divided his own collection into five, entrusting one subdivision each to Vatsya, Mudgala, Shalya, Gokalya, and Shashira. The sage Jatukanya was also a disciple of Shakalya, and after dividing the samhita he received from Shakalya into three parts, he added a fourth section, a Vedic glossary, Nirukti. He taught one of these parts to each of four disciples, Balaka, the second Pila, Jabala, and Viraj. Bhaskali assembled the Valikilya Samhita, a collection from all the branches of the Rig Veda. This collection was received by Valyani, Bhajya, and Kashar. Thus these various Samhitas of the Rig Veda were maintained through disciplic succession by these saintly Brahmanas. Simply by hearing of this distribution of the Vedic hymns, one will be freed from all sins. The disciples of Vaishampayan became authorities in the Atharva Veda. They were known as the Charakas because they executed strict vows to free their guru from his sin of killing a Brahmana. Once Yajnavalkya, one of the disciples of Vaishampayan, said, O Master, how much benefit will be derived from the feeble endeavors of these weak disciples of yours? I will personally perform some outstanding penance. Addressed thus, the spiritual master Vaishampayan became angry and said, Go away from here, enough of you, O disciple who insults Brahmanas. Furthermore, you must immediately give back everything I have taught you. Purport. See Vaishapayan was angry because one of his disciples, Yajnavalkya, was insulting the other disciples who were, after all, qualified Brahmins. Just as a father is disturbed when one son mistreats the father's other children, the spiritual master is very displeased if a proud disciple insults or mistreats the guru's other disciples. 64 to 65. Yajnavalkya, the son of Devarat, then vomited the mantras of the four Yajurvedas and went away from there. The assembled disciples, looking greedily upon these Yajur hymns, assumed the forms of partridges and picked them up. These divisions of the Yajurveda therefore became known as the most beautiful Taittiriya Samhita, the hymns collected by partridges. Purport. According to Srila Srila Swami, it's improper for a Brahmana to collect what has been vomited, and so the powerful Brahmana disciples of Vaishampayan assumed the form of titiras, partridges, and collected the valuable mantras. My dear Brahmana Shonaka, Yajnavalkya then desired to find out new Yajur mantras unknown to even his spiritual master. With this in mind, he offered attentive worship to the powerful Lord of the Sun. Sri Yajnavalkya said, "I offer my respectful obeisances to the Supreme Personality of Godhead appearing as the sun. You are present as the controller of the four kinds of living entities, beginning from Brahma and extending down to the blades of grass. Just as the sky is present both inside and outside of all living of every living being, you exist both within the heart of all as the supersoul and externally in the form of time. Just as the sky cannot be covered by the clouds present within it, you are never covered by any false material designation. By the flow of years, which are made up of the tiny fragments of time called chanas, lavas, and nimeshas, you alone maintain this world, drying up the waters and giving them back as rain." So the purport here describes how this prayer isn't offered to the sun as an entity independent of the Supreme Lord, but rather as a powerful expansion of the Lord, the Sun God. 68. Oh, glowing one. So there are some prayers. There's not much longer to this. So please, otherwise you won't get your benediction. You won't get your Shruti Phal if you don't listen. O glowing one, O powerful Lord of the Sun, you are the chief of all the demigods. I meditate with careful attention on your fiery globe, because for those who offer prayers to you three times daily according to the Vedic method passed down through authorized disciplic succession, you burn away all sinful activities, all consequent suffering, and even the original seed of desire. You are personally present as the indwelling Lord in the hearts of all moving and non-moving beings who depend completely on your shelter. Indeed, you animate their material minds, senses, and vital airs to act. So the sun, the Savitri, is known as the animator. He brings everyone to life. And we see this, practically speaking, that when the sun is arising by the potency of the sun, everyone is awakened up into activity. So he is known as the animator in this sense. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur comments, "You as the Antayami put into motion the unconscious mind, senses, and life airs of all the moving and non-moving beings under your shelter. You put into motion the unconscious mind and senses." So it's quite interesting, because we tend again to think of ourselves as the doer, the active force, the one who makes things happen. But what is making us happen in the way that we are happening? So many thoughts come to our mind. We can't control them, practically speaking. They bubble up from where? Who knows? When we go to sleep and we dream so many amazing things. that may or may not have to do with what we're thinking during the day or at the time we go to sleep. A composite of so many thoughts that we have, and from where they come and how they come, we don't know. So ultimately, we are not the impeller. We are not the one who is giving force to our life, to our existence. Some days we can't do anything, no matter how much we try. Some days the phones keep going off. But at least you use Nokia. We're proud of you. So ultimately, all this energy comes from, for each of us, and just see how powerful he is. It comes from Krishna. It's not coming from me. It's obvious that my own life isn't springing just from me. Yes, I'm one of the doers. Yes, I have something to do with it. But what is the cause of my pride then? What is the cause of my pride as if I'm doing it? So the great devotees, they don't see themselves, or even an intelligent person, they don't see themselves as the karta, as the doer. They see Krishna as the karta, is the doer. And therefore, since he is doing, they wish to use their ability, their part in the equation of doing, they wish to use that in his service. They don't take that philosophy and say, well, I don't, you know, that do improper things and then say that, I'm not the doer. But because, although the philosophy of action and inaction is difficult to understand, it's clear who is getting the results of the action. And it's not Krishna. It is me. This point was brought up by Brihaspati. That every wise person should know this and not engage in be impelled by the Lord, but our meaning that we are ultimately dependent on him. But not think that we are either the doers, or not think that we are independent, and rather we should see our part and use our small part with bhakti to make offerings to Krishna. Krishna. So that impelling is done by the supersoul and the energy of the sun, that gives the sun its energy. Because if we don't think about it, but if we do think about it, the sun, we're all dependent on the sun. When the sun's not out, everyone's mind becomes a little peculiar. Not to criticize England or anything like that, but when the sun's not out, and it's even understood that in countries where like Sweden, where the sun isn't out for 6 months of the year, the suicide rate is so much higher. People kill themselves. So this sun, which gives us so much, you know, everything in this world practically is dependent on the sun, and this point will come out later. Later, this is one of the final things in a later chapter that's going to be described, how we're dependent on the sun. And this sun, it's there it is. It's just, we take it for granted. It's sitting up there in the sky, and year after year, or start with day after day, and then month after month, and year after year, and then decade after decade, and century after century, and generation after generation, and millennium after millennium, it's generating sunlight and heat just at the right temperature for life as we know it to exist. And how is it all going on? Who's paying the electric bills? You know, it's just going on. So the scientists have say it's going on. There's some type of a nuclear fusion. But because they can say some words on it, they really don't know what's going on. They don't even know what's going on in a piece of paper, what to speak of the sun.
They don't understand one cell of the body. They don't understand the digestion, how things are assimilated in the body deeply, fully, completely. So because they can say, well, there's some thermonuclear reaction going on in the core of the sun that's... But that doesn't... It's quite as outstanding and astonishing if one thinks about it. If one is conscious and non-duplicitous, not deceitful, one can't help but come to the conclusion that there's something, someone behind all this. And this is just the sun, what to speak of the other arrangements of matter. And the moon is required too. What do they say? They say the moon is required to stabilize the tilt in the orbit of the earth. As if they put the moon there so it would function that way. And gravity is in place because... as if they discovered it, as if it was lost or something. But if one had a little bit of common sense, one would, and wasn't over intellectualizing things, one would think, yes, it appears that there is some order here, and that there's some orderer, and there's someone who's doing the most incredible thing. There's something going on here that's so far beyond my ability that I'm depending on it every moment. Even the functioning of my body, I'm completely dependent on it. It's always going on. It's beyond me. So we are dependent on Krishna. So what can we do? We can make our offerings. So this sun is the impeller. That's what Vishwanath says. Even the unconscious, you put into motion the anatmana, the unconscious mind, is how it's translated here in senses. The world has been seized and swallowed by the python of darkness. Oops. When there are technical chapters like that, if you read completely out of place, no one notices anyway. So. No, we're just teasing. The world has been seized and swallowed by the python of darkness in its horrible mouth, and has become unconscious, as if dead. But mercifully glancing upon the sleeping people of the world, you raise them up with the gift of sight. Thus, you are most magnanimous. As the three sacred junctions of each day, you engage the pious in the path of ultimate good, inducing them to perform religious duties that situate them in their spiritual position. So the purpose of action, which the sun impels, is spiritual duties. It is not sense enjoyment, which the modern so-called world, so-called civilization, tries very hard to convince us that we should consume and consume and consume and enjoy, and we should earn and earn and earn so that we should consume and enjoy, and we should spend so we can earn, so we can consume, so we can enjoy, and we should, if we don't spend enough, we should go into debt to spend. Don't let the fact that you don't have money stop you from spending and consuming and enjoying. But that's not the purpose of human life, even Yajnavalkya is saying here. Just like an earthy king, you travel everywhere spreading fear among the unholy, as the powerful deities of the directions offer you in their folded palms lotus flowers and other respectful presentations. Therefore, my Lord, I am prayerfully approaching your lotus feet, which are honored by the spiritual masters of the three worlds, because I hope to receive from you mantras of the Yajurveda unknown to anyone else. So he's done something, Yajnavalkya has done something that we would normally think of as improper. He's criticized his fellow students And so much so that his teacher has rejected him, and all that he learned from his teacher, and he doesn't care, he goes away, and by his own powers he's going to gain spiritual knowledge from the sun. So we'd think that was improper, but this is a great sage, actually, and he has an Upanishad. He takes part in the Upanishadic literatures. And satisfied, so the son didn't reject him at all, but satisfied by such glorification, the powerful sun god assumed the form of a horse and presented to the sage Yajnavalkya yajur mantras previously unknown in human society. From these countless hundreds of mantras of the Yajurveda, the powerful sage compiled 15 new branches of Vedic literature. These became known as the Vyajasanay Samhita because they were produced from the hairs of the horse's mane, and they were accepted in the disciplic succession by the followers of Kanva, Madhyandina, and other rishis. Jaimini Rishi, the authority of the Samaveda, had a son named Sumantu, so that was about the Yajurveda. And there's Upanishads, the white and black, I believe, Taittiriya Upanishads, which have to do with the information gained by Yajurveda, by Yajnavalkya, one of them does, I believe. Jaimini Rishi, the authority of the Samaveda, now to the Samaveda, had a son named Sumantu, and the son of Sumantu was Sutvan. The sage Jaimini spoke to each of them a different part of the Samaveda Samhita. Sukoma, another disciple of Jaimini, was a great scholar. He divided the mighty tree of the Samaveda into 1,000 Samhitas. Then, O Brahmana, three disciples of Sukoma, Hiranyanabha, the son of Kosala, Poshyanji, and Avantya, who was very advanced in spiritual realization, took charge of the Sama Mantras. The 500 disciples of Poshyanji and Avantya became known as the northern singers of the Samaveda, and in later times some of them also became known as the eastern singers. Five other disciples of Poshyanji named Lagakshi, Mangali, Kulya, Kushida, and Kukshi each received 100 Samhitas. Krita, the disciple of Hiranyanabha, spoke 24 Samhitas to his own disciples, and the remaining collections were passed down by the self-realized sage Avantya. Thus in the purports of the humble servants of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, to the 12th canto, 6th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Maharaj Prakrit's Passing Away. So we'll hear more about the Puranic literatures tomorrow, and then the next section begins. The next section is three chapters, of which we will hear the first of those chapters about Markandeya Rishi. We shall hear that tomorrow, if Krishna will. Okay. Any questions or comments? Yes.
Can you please repeat? You were explaining how Sudha Goswami was able to understand the Bhagavatam. What enabled him to understand?
He said that he... I'll read it directly. This was his final verse over here on 35. Namo bhagavate tasmai krishne yukunta medasa yat padam bruha dhyanyat. Upon his feet I have meditated on Krishna's feet. Simply by meditating on his feet, I have been able to study and appreciate this great literature. Adhyagam means assimilated. Because the scripture, I've been able to assimilate it by the meditation on his lotus feet. In other words, by his mercy also.
Samitam adyagam imam. This I have assimilated, this samhita I have assimilated, yat padam bruha dhyanat. On Krishna, Kunta made us on the Krishna who's invincible, translated here, whose power is never impeded or stopped. So this is so wonderful, because if Krishna decides to allow us to assimilate the Bhagavatam, his power is unstoppable. So if somehow we could get his mercy, if somehow we can get Krishna's mercy, because his power is unstoppable, then our own limitations, even that cannot stop Krishna's mercy from flowing to us. Yeah.
Do you think there is some instructional purpose in putting the story of Yajnavalkya right in this place? It seems to be quite curious, right after describing the glory of the Bhagavatam and the conclusion, basically, of the Bhagavatam narration to Parikshit, and describing the Vedic literature, then we hear about a disciple who was rejected by his guru, who seems to have managed, because of seeming...
been successful.
Right, but was successful, very successful.
Yes.
So... is there some point in that?
I couldn't discern one other than the general point of what's going on there. When you're talking about the history of the Vedic literatures, Yajnavalkya has to come up. But a specific point on why, on his unique presence and what he did, I couldn't understand anything, nor did any acharya that I saw comment.
Certainly, it does sound encouraging that even a person who ran into some trouble was able to get some mercy.
But what mercy did he get?
He got the darshan of the Surya Narayan and got direct instructions from him.
Yeah. Did you want to comment on this?
Yeah, I was just thinking, if he was writing what he was saying, he was being positive about, he wasn't criticizing his other disciples because, you know, he was proud, but because he could see that, you know, there was a deficiency there, and therefore it wouldn't be really at fault, would it? He was trying to point something out.
Pointing something out to who?
Yeah.
See, that's his right, but just understand, he's trying to point out something to his spiritual master, that his spiritual master was so foolish that he hadn't noticed. So he was speaking like that, which is another indication of his pride. And look, it's not like the disciples were weak on one level. Maybe Yajnavalkya was more qualified, but he was critical and insulting of them, because what did they do right after? They turned into partridges, so they had powers too, and they assimilated the rest and propagated the rest of the... Maybe he's the most powerful, but because you're most powerful, it doesn't give you the right to insult the others. So the others who may have less power but are still their exalted personalities. So we could see the rightness or wrongness of his action by how Vaishampanya, who was a spiritual heavyweight, so to speak, how he reacted to it. And how did he react? He was angry, he was upset. So there's some impropriety that's being pointed to. But yet, which is the point that Adi Purusha is making, yet, still he was so powerful that he gained he gained so much even without the mercy from his spiritual master. He went directly to the Lord himself. So when great personalities do things, all I can think of is that maybe something we can understand from it, really positive from it, that he did it certainly, but we have to, yeah, but things that we shouldn't do that are mentioned that are in there too. Yeah, maybe others have insights on this. Prashanta?
Yeah, I was saying that what we are hearing here is the descent of the Vedic knowledge.
Yes, that's clear.
And maybe one point could be that this knowledge descends, and sometimes in spite of the weakness of the teachers, mm-hmm. in spite of that, still it has to come down. And sometimes, because we see, what I felt is that these ones who turned into birds, they were also not clear. Like it says, they felt greedy over the mantra. It didn't sound too good, that description I felt. So it's like the whole bunch of disciples. Well,
yeah, and we could also say that after the instructions that Sutta gave is that you shouldn't respond to angry words with more harsh and angry words, and one could think that Vaishampanya, he responded in that way, and the disciples were like this and he was like that. Yeah, it's hard to penetrate. But you're saying that when something is going to happen in a spiritual sense, Krishna can use anyone he wants to use. But it's also clear that the essence is going to be lost as Kali Yuga comes, and that's what really comes out by the end of the next chapter, that as the thing branches off and each people gets more and more specialized and it branches even further and they pick one part and they make it as if it's the whole, then the real essence of the whole thing is lost. And therefore, Srila Vyasadeva is empowered. The Lord's mercy comes to reestablish it. So I think, because it's his work ultimately,
there is a comment on this, like when on purport there is Prabhupada is explaining that sage life is also not perfect, like
the
sage's life, like Vasishtha and Vishwamitra are always quarreling, there is there among them, that's why better to be a devotee.
Yeah, so the difference between sages and devotees, I don't think there's ever a mention that Yajnavalkya was a, for example, was a Bhakta, he's, from what I remember, he was more of a jnani.
Upanishad comes from him.
So much for that theory of mine. Yeah? What else, though? Where is that? Where he's talking about, he's talking to his wife, as one of the Upanishads, Taittiriya Upanishad, where... Yeah, very mysterious. Therefore, in Kali Yuga, we need something less mysterious.
About Chakravalaka, in one of the Upanishads, I don't remember which Upanishad, but I think it's a king and he's promising to the Brahmins that one who can answer these questions, then I will give him all these cows in charity. And then Chakravalka arrives with his son, and he says to his son, "Oh son, collect all these cows, I will answer these
questions." Is this Jabala? Was that his son? Jabala Upanishad.
That's quite extraordinary.
Yeah. He was a special person, obviously. Yeah. Any other comments on this point? And then before we ask for other questions, yes?
It seems these are the Gayatri mantras, no? These are these prayers to Sangha. Who by waking and by Dimashi.
Yes.
In Srimad Bhagavatam, supposed to be Gayatri
Mantra. Yeah.
Nice point.
What was the point?
About the Gayatri Mantra. Explaining that the Bhagavatam is an expansion of the Gayatri Mantra. There's actually comments. I think that comes a bit. That'll come also at the end in the final chapter. That the Bhagavatam begins with Gayatri Mantra and ends with it.
Shijiva comments that this 67, 68, 69 are expansions of the three padas of the Gayatri.
Oh.
They kind of explain.
Yeah, very, quite wonderfully. Yeah, thank you. Any more about Jagyavalkya? This wonderful personality.
I have a question. It seems in his prayers that he considers the Son of the Supreme Personality of God.
Yes, but we pierce through that by the mercy of the Acharyas and see the potent behind the potency of the Son. Mm-hmm. So when we worship the Lord Narayan through the or Krishna even or our worshipable deity through the Gayatri Mantra, through that mantra, then we're not worshipping the sun god, we're worshipping the Surya Narayan. Yes.
In fact, 69 says that five disciples of Bhakshanji, they sing each 100 samhitas. And there has been divisions and divisions of all the Vedas, four Vedas. So there must be many, many samhitas written. Is there any book describing the messages of all these samhitas in a concise way?
Yes. It's called the Srimad Bhagavatam. Which is the point here, really the point here. That this is why this whole, I mean, the basic reason why all this, and it goes on to the next chapter, all the Vedic literatures and its expansions and it, where it originally comes from and where it ends up right before. Put that shoe back. Did the monkey listen to me?
No.
Huh? Why doesn't someone convince the monkey that he should leave the shoe? Okay, let's get out the banana weapons. The higher taste. So the purpose of the section is really to say that the Bhagavatam, this is what happens to the Vedic literature, it expands out, and the Bhagavatam is the ripened fruit of the Vedas. That's the purpose of it. This is in a concise way, this is what we have, because these greats, we could also think of Yajnavalkya is so powerful that he was able to please the Lord who gave him these mantras, and all the essence, the best part in one sense, of all the, not only of the Yajurveda, but of the entirety of all the Vedic literatures is given in the Bhagavatam. We should take it. That's really the point. And it's a wonderful point. And it's a very mysterious point. So we can't really touch all the details of these things. But this is really ancient history. And it's hard to really discern why and what happened in ancient history. But here, take the fruit. There's a whole huge tree that's expanded out. And here, there's the fruit. Take it. Get to the essence. Because there's Chaturvedis, Trivedis, Duvedis, whatever, and Ekavedis. You know, there's persons whose family lineage, they were students of either the four Vedas, the three Vedas, the two Vedas, or one Veda. This is their family lineage. We see these people with these names. But here's the essence.
in the Bhagavatam.
There's no one with the name Srila Bhagavatam.
Near Bhagavat in the Kirtan.
Yes, to some family lineage, we know they have ended Bhagavatam.
They have what?
Ended in Bhagavat. So I'm wondering why Janamajaya is angry with Dakshaka, because Dakshaka is the just instrument. With this Brahma body is the main cause of Dakshaka.
I mean, why doesn't he get angry with the Brahmins? There's already so much trouble in the family because Maharaj Prakriti got angry with the Brahmin by the mercy of Krishna. Kashyapa Muni. Same Kashyapa Muni. Because he, from him, in ultimately came all the serpents in the family, so he was, because he, yeah, Diti and Aditi, there's so many wonderful creatures came from Kashyap, if I remember correctly. Distracted. So you could say, how could he be distracted? But how could he be distracted? But how? How did, yeah.
I think it's mentioned in Tattva Sandarbha that he knew that this has to happen, so.
And why does it have to happen?
Parikshit goes back on back to Kali.
That's on one level, and because Kali Yuga has to come. Why does Kali Yuga have to come? Yeah, the sinful reactions that are just building up, it has to happen. You can't perform actions and not get the results of those actions. So the sinful reactions build up, so the cycle of Kali Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, Treta Yuga, Satya Yuga, it has to come. And it can't come in the presence of Prakriti Maharaj. He has to leave. And Krishna wants him home anyway. So ultimately behind this is Krishna. And that's the vision of a devotee. He sees Krishna's hand everywhere. And this is what's been described, even when we look at the more jnana type of sections in the end of Uddhava Gita, and even what Sukadeva is saying to Maharaj Prakriti right at the last. It's to see, although somewhat intellectually, to see that Krishna is the thread that pervades all in existence, that nothing happens independently of him to anyone, to Maharaj Prakriti or even to me. So this type of vision is glorious vision. It is the vision of a devotee. But it's not what devotees ultimately want to see. They want to see Krishna. They want to serve Krishna. But yet, it's how they see, too. When the gopis were presented with this type of knowledge by Uddhav, by Krishna, even when Krishna presented it in Kurukshetra, even Krishna said that, you know, what could happen, you know, what to do, you know, we're separated, but ultimately it's the Supreme Lord who brings everyone together and separates them. And the gopis said, okay, but you're the Supreme Lord. Don't forget that part of it. You're the Supreme Lord. And then they said, oh, we can understand that Krishna has this habit of always giving this knowledge. What can you do when someone has that as his nature? You can't change a person's nature. He always wants to give knowledge. But they weren't satisfied with that. They were satisfied with him. They only wanted his association. But yet, the devotees, this is their solace. To see how Krishna is personally dealing with them in something that another person would see as very rough. The devotees see or very difficult dealings. A devotee's vision is that he can see Krishna's kindness in everything. So that type of vision gives one the capacity to it can't be done unless one's advanced, unless one actually has a well-developed relationship with Krishna. It's not an intellectual adjustment. It means that one has to have complete trust in Krishna. That means that one has to know him quite well. One's relationship has to be deeply developed, otherwise we get knocked over by the circumstances of life. That's a simple thing that we learn. One of the purposes why Krishna acts the way he does with the gopis, because we get to watch them. We get to watch Nanda Maharaj. We get to watch Yashoda Maya. We get to watch. But especially we get to watch the gopis, however Krishna treats them, they're only thinking of his welfare. They're so deeply immersed in their loving relationship with him. So Krishna will disappear from their sight just so that he and we hear their words of continued love and devotion for his lotus feet. So then we understand how glorious these residents of Vrindavan are. And then we understand that to be a devotee is not cheap. It's not on the surface. It's the deepest of all deep things. It takes such depth of surrender in one's consciousness. It takes such depth of realization. It takes such depth of sadhana, of practice. Such eternal commitment. It's a big thing, eternal commitment. Because it's forever. You know what I mean? Forever is a long time. The residents of Vrindavan, they krita punja punja. How else did they sakyam visharu krita punja punja? How else did they perform so many lives of performing spiritually potent bhakti to allow them to intimately play with Krishna and treat him just like a friend? So trusted. There's not an element, there's not the slightest element of untrustworthiness in their consciousness. There's not the slightest element, what was the word that was used by Suta Goswami about who Maya attacks? There's no deceit in their consciousness. In other words, they are Krishna's and only Krishna's. No percent for themselves, not even one half of 1.1%. That's bhakti. That's devotion. That's Krishna consciousness. And when we are pure on that level, then that we don't have to worry about anything. Until then, our life is full of worries, but the worries are caused by Maya, by our mind, by the reactions of the material energy in our mind, because of the thing that we have that allows Maya to catch all of us. The impurities, the hypocrisy, the treachery in the heart. And Maharaj Prakrit, he was over that. He was over all that. He was Krishna's. He was so intimate with Krishna that Krishna, while he was still in the womb, before he even did anything in his life, Krishna came and personally protected him and personally was angry. He was personally angry. His eyes were red with anger as he was protecting him with the club, because his devotee was being threatened by the, not verbally threatened, but being attacked by the Brahmastra thrown by Asatthama. And it's also so interesting that even though Asatthama did that and he tried to kill all the Pandavas and including Maharaj Prakrit, still in the womb, still, he wasn't eternally condemned for that. He later, he had to walk off his offenses, and he wandered around, and he became purified, and he became who? Vyasadeva, an incarnation of the Lord's potency entered into him. So there's always hope, which was what you were saying about Yajnavalkya. There is always hope. But sometimes we have to go through things. but then when we're going through them, we should take responsibility and not blame everyone else. This is what Brihaspati was saying. Just, okay, this is happening. Krishna's mercy on me. I must have done something, because this isn't happening to everyone else. I must have done something. There must be some fault in me. Of course, I never have any faults. But that's what the false ego says. I never have any faults. How could this be a reaction against something I've done when I'm perfect, powerful, and happy, which is the definition of demonic mentality?
We are in the process of purification and of realizing our mantras for those like me, for instance. And it's like, is there a way to find out what is the extent of our anatta so that we can recognize them properly? Because sometimes we think that we are dovetailing everything in Krishna consciousness as much as we can, but you know, sometimes we cannot see how we are.
But we can also see that the core anatta is our arrogance in one sense, our pride. So, pride and envy, because they spring from Krishna, from our relationship with Krishna, our part in the relationship with Krishna. So as much as our pride and envy are there, then we can see that the rest of the material existence is manifesting, and as much as we're humble servants of humble servants, not masters. As much as we can, that consciousness is manifesting, we can see. So Prabhupada would say that you don't have to take an examination from others. You can see yourself. Examine yourself, how much these qualities, lust, anger, greed, etc., have vanished from the heart. How much are we detached from the world of matter? And how much are we attached to Krishna? Where do we look for our security? And what happens when someone touches the sensitive point in our false ego? Where do we turn for shelter? And how quickly do we reassemble the full sense of self? And other than being humble, yeah. So just as it, yes, and we can also see the behavior we read about and see the behavior of great Vaishnavas. They're very humble. And then, so we also learn how to imitate, you know, on the outside, the great humility. How to appear to be like that. So we learn that. So we have to, instead of learning all these other things, we should learn how to become servants of Vaishnavas, of everyone. Did that address your question or not? Any other comments or questions? But the Bhagavatam is the very means of conquest. So I tend to think that that the more we become absorbed, because this is really what's mentioned, it's the positive, it's the absorption in the positive in Krishna's, in the Bhagavatam, in the holy names, in our offerings, making the offerings, that first of all, that brings to our attention the negative, but it's that's what we want. We don't want to get too absorbed in how fallen and rascal we are, and if I'm in a good mood, this is really bad, because if it just happens to happen one day, it's really bad because I'm not aware of what a bigger rascal I am for a few minutes. Just want to get absorbed in our service, in the Bhagavatam, in preaching, in the holy names. Because the false ego in the mind is so tricky. If you stop playing with it too much, you get really entangled in it. And Krishna is really tricky too. Because if you start thinking about him too much, you get entangled in him. So that's what we want to do. That's why the essence of the Krishna consciousness movement, it's got to do with hearing and chanting about Krishna, and helping others hear about and chant about Krishna, and helping others hear and chant about Krishna will not get in the way of our hearing and chanting about Krishna, because we want to talk about Krishna to others and give Krishna to others. So that's the central point. And because we're not so qualified, perhaps after all, this is Kali Yuga, when then our qualifications aren't very high. Because just look at someone like Yajnavalkya came up. So look, what an incredible person he was. Even did that, and he was able to approach get a response from the Lord in the heart, from the Antyami. So powerful. So what is our position in Kali Yuga? You know, so unqualified. Manda sumanda mateo manda abhagya upadutaha. We heard about the horrors of Kali, and you know, where this is our homeland. We've taken our birth in there. So we really need some special mercy. So we have the holy names, we have the Bhagavatam, and we have the preaching movement. Because in preaching we gain some special flavor, some special grace by Krishna by helping others. This is the conclusion. Because we don't have the qualification so much by ourselves, so we need some special mercy. So how to get some extra mercy? So how to get extra mercy within our capacity? I remember so many times in the very early days when I would write to Prabhupada, please give me your special mercy, give me your special mercy, because there was mercy, but then there was special mercy I heard about, so I wanted special mercy. I mean, it was superficial, but you know, just being clever, actually. But then when Prabhupada actually did give me special mercy, he had me do things that were very, very, actually very difficult to do. I wasn't capable of digesting the special mercy and getting it. So we have to go at our speed. And instead of trying to be the one who gets the most special mercy, maybe it's more practical if we just serve people who are getting more mercy than we are, and things like that. It's more practical, you know, and not be just be insignificant servants. That's all we can ever really be. Not try to push forward ourselves. Just help. Just be assistants. And then Krishna wants to give us so much mercy despite our lack of qualification. Okay, that's up to him. But until that's really clear, he wants me to save the world and etc., etc. Just keep... Just be a humble servant. Humble servant of the servant of the servant of the servant of the servant, like that. And you can see that it's very difficult to do that even. Such a tendency for the false ego to want to push forward, me. How about me? Didn't you notice I'm here? You know, those kind of things. Haven't you noticed yet? You could see it. Yeah, there's so many times when the false ego rears its head like that, when it doesn't get the gratification that it wants in devotional service. It just comes up, it rears its head, you know, like, you know, if you're a disciple of Prabhupada or something, and they're passing around the ghee lamp, you know, in the arti, and they don't give you the ghee lamp or something, and, you know, you watch yourself. You watch the false ego come up like that. So these are the indications that we don't want that. We recognize that. We don't want that. We see that Krishna is holding up the mirror. That's the specialty of Vrindavan. Holds up the mirror. And then when you see yourself, you see the disparity, the difference between what you were hoping you looked like and what you actually look like. So, kal, tomorrow, we shall hear more about the Puranic literatures and how they expanded, and ultimately to say that just all these great sages have spread this and they've disseminated and they've expanded it, and now it's all contracted into one book. All the essence is contracted into one book, the Srimad Bhagavatam. And when Srila Prabhupada had this Bhagavatam, he was ready to come and preach. Even one part of it, he was ready to come and distribute Krishna consciousness to the world. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srila Prabhupada bhakti vrinda ki jai.